With Iran in negotiations with six world powers, including the United States, to halt or at least slow the growth of their nuclear capabilities, there's been a failure to reach interim agreement. Now negotiations are set to pick up again on November 20th.
And that is the backdrop for our next guest. His new book takes stock of the last nine countries with nuclear programs which hold between them 17,000 nuclear weapons.
Joseph Cernciony is with us now. He's the president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board and the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. Joseph, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I want to start by reading a bit from your book. It says, few people think about nuclear weapons. They believe the threats have ended or plans are in place to prevent nuclear catastrophe. They are dead wrong. Why do we, what is wrong with our thinking about nuclear weapons? Are we thinking in an outdated mode? Should we still be frightened?
Well, I think very few people wake up in the morning thinking about nuclear weapons. We generally think of these things as something left over from the Cold War. We assume that more or less they've been taken care of. If you think about them at all, maybe it's from a country like Iran. You worry that Iran might get a nuclear weapon. It's hard to avoid that. But that's seen as sort of a, you know, an isolated case. The truth is that these weapons pose multiple risks to us, not just that a new country like Iran could get them, not just that there could be a nuclear conflict in South Asia between India and Pakistan, who have about 200 nuclear weapons between them and have fought three wars over the last 60 years. But there's a danger from the existing stockpiles. These are the most powerful weapons ever created. One is capable of destroying a city. A dozen could destroy a nation, and a few hundred could cause disaster to the entire planet. And they're in the hands of fallible humans. People make mistakes. Things go wrong. Shuttles blow up. Fingers slip on switches. So as long as these nuclear weapons exist, as President Obama reminded us in Berlin this summer, no one is truly safe. We have to take much more urgent steps to reduce the threats from all these weapons in all these countries.
Now, there are nine countries that still have nuclear weapons today. Now, that's a pretty drastic decrease from what it used to be. And as a general rule, it seems as though many countries are reducing their nuclear stockpile. So that's good news, isn't it?
And that is the good news. You know, these threats, as serious as they are actually a small fraction of what they used to be. And it's because of policies that countries adopted. And many of these policies were championed by the United States. You know, John F. Kennedy famously worried that if something weren't done in the beginning of the 60s, we could end up with 15, 20, or 25 nations by the 1970s. And these were real concerns. These were countries like Sweden and Australia that had nuclear programs, Japan, Germany, countries we had just defeated in World War II, were thinking about nuclear programs. Well, fortunately for us, Kennedy and others acted. You know, they took steps to limit the testing of nuclear weapons, to start disarmament of nuclear weapons, and to build a non-proliferation regime that convinced most of those countries not to go nuclear in the first place. We still went through a Cold War where people built up to ridiculous levels of weaponry. There used to be 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, most held by the Soviet Union and the United States. And thanks to policies that were championed by Ronald Reagan, Herbert Walker Bush, and Bill Clinton, and now Barack Obama, Democrats and Republicans have helped slash those arsenals down. The trend is clearly down. There are fewer weapons in the world, fewer states with these weapons. In fact, more countries have given up weapons and programs in the last 25 years than have tried to get them.
Well, I want to go to Iran right now because that's sort of where the world's attention is focused in terms of nuclear programs. Where do we stand right now?
I'll be happy to tell you. By the way, I should give a caveat here. Although I'm on Secretary Kerry's International Security Advisory Board, these are purely my opinions, and I don't speak for the Department of Defense or the U.S. government in any way, which should be obvious. We are very close to a deal with Iran. In fact, and here's some breaking news, there's a story going out right now that it looks like Secretary Kerry may be heading back to Geneva on Tuesday for the next round of negotiations with the Iranians. We came very, very close last weekend to a deal with Iran. And this negotiations that are going on between the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, they call it the P5 plus one, and Iran. And they came excruciatingly close, but they couldn't quite go all the way. The Iranian negotiators had to go back to the capital, get new instructions. From what I understand, there is now solid agreement among the P5, including France, the UK, Russia, China, Germany, and the United States, and Iran on the text of an initial phase of an agreement. If this holds, we could see next week the signing of an historic deal, a deal that countries have been trying to get with Iran for 10 years and have failed. We could be on the edge of it.
Now, that would be big news indeed. Now, are you talking about an interim agreement, or are you talking about, you know, the whole enchilada?
Well, the whole nuclear enchilada. Well, it's that's seen as too big a meal to eat all at once. You've got to go in phases. I had dinner with President Rouhani of Iran up in New York in September, and we asked him this question: why not go for a big deal all at once? And he said what many of his American counterparts were saying, that it's too complicated, that you have to take a simple step to build confidence that you can take the next two steps and so on and so on. So this deal is designed to go in phases. And the first phase will deal with the most urgent threat, the ability of Iran to break out and rush to build a nuclear weapon. Right now, Iran has enough nuclear material that if they decided to go for a weapon, they could probably get enough material for the core of a bomb within a matter of weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, something like that. It would take them many more months to actually build a crude nuclear device, and probably a year or so to have one that's deliverable by a plane or a truck. But that's still too short a period. So the deal would lengthen that breakout time. It would have them stop enriching uranium to what they call the 20% level, have them get rid of some of those stocks, lengthen the amount of time it would take them to break out. They would accept limits on their facilities. They would open up for more inspections. And in return, we would start loosening some of the sanctions, but not take apart the sanction regime. That's the first step. That would be followed by several more phases where we'd gradually start to roll back the program, and in return, we would start rolling back the rest of the sanctions. We expect this whole process would take somewhere between 6 and 9 months.
Now, we've been watching as the Israelis and the French last week, you know, were saying of the interim agreement, you know, hang on, this isn't nearly enough. We're not getting enough for what we're giving. Do you think that the plan that you just outlined has addressed those fears and that can be something that's put to bed going forward?
I think it's addressed the French concerns. What I understand, the French are now on board. There are some, and this includes Prime Minister Netanyahu, who have what they call a maximalist approach, that he doesn't want limits on the program. He wants the whole program abolished, you know, sort of the Carthage approach. You raise the whole structure and then salt the soil so it can never grow again. That is the ideal deal. He's not crazy to think that. You want to get rid of all the enrichment capabilities. It's just that it's not a deal you can get. There's no politician in Iran that could agree to that right now. So the phased approach is the most politically feasible approach at this time. You limit it, you start to constrain it, you build up confidence between the different parties, and make sure that you can verify every step of it. I think in the end, that approach has got so much support that it's going to prevail, including support among many members of Israel's military and intelligence apparatus. And in the end, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu will be satisfied with the verifiability of this arrangement.
Now, in your book, you write about how there have been voices in the past who have said, you know, we should just target these nuclear plants, we should destroy them. And, you know, on another note, the people saying in op-ed pieces that really the Iranian mullahs don't think like a Westerner would think. They are concerned with the afterlife and that we can't really count on Iran being rational about its nuclear weapons. Would this agreement, do you think, address those voices as well?
No. Those people who think that are not going to be satisfied by this agreement. So if you think that the Iranians are crazy, that they're irrational, that if they were able to build a bomb, they would, and if they had it, they would use it. No, this is not going to address your concern. The Iranians have been working on nuclear technology since the Shah, so for over four decades. Now, there is a base of knowledge in that country you cannot eradicate. You could not physically stop Iran from building a bomb unless you invaded the country and took it over. And that would require several hundred thousand U.S. troops, and it's not even clear that would even be enough. Well, there's no appetite in the United States for going to war with Iran. We are not going to do that. So the only way to do this, then, is to convince Iran that it's not in their interest. I think you can do that. There's lots of reasons for just Iran's point of view why building a bomb is not in their interest. And President Rouhani actually has said this. If we get a nuclear bomb, our neighbors are going to feel compelled to get it, and then we will lose the military advantage we currently have. Iran has got a conventional military force that can repel any invader. But if Saudi Arabia, for example, were to get a nuclear bomb, Iran would actually be less secure, more threatened. So there's solid security reasons for Iran not to get it. We want to add to those security arrangements. But if you think they're crazy, well, then that whole lane, that cost-benefit calculation doesn't really apply to them. I actually don't think there's any evidence that they're like that. People have thought this about countries in the past. They thought Stalin was crazy. They thought Mao was crazy. But it turns out that most of these states are actually rational actors, and they can be affected by a cost-benefit calculation. Some combination of pressures and incentive can convince these countries they can meet their goals by non-nuclear means, or if not, deter them from ever using a nuclear weapon they might have gotten.
Well, we're talking with Joseph Cernciony right now. He's the president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and he has a new book out. It's called Nuclear Nightmare, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late.
And we're taking your calls next. Do you think that the U.S. has taken enough of a leadership position against proliferation? What should that role be? And do you think we need nukes to keep the world safe? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And don't forget, you can also post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the continued threat of nuclear weapons in the world today with Joseph Cernciony. He's a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board. He has a new book out. It's called Nuclear Nightmares.
And we're taking your calls next. And what do you think about that threat these days? Does it feel different to you now than it may have felt, say, during the Cold War? Are nuclear weapons something to be taken seriously? And if so, how do we demonstrate that? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or give us a post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Joseph, leaving Iran for a moment, you say the real country to be worried about is Pakistan. Why Pakistan?
Pakistan already has 100 nuclear weapons. Iran might someday get one or two. They have enough material to build 100 more. They have a very weak government. They have a collapsing economy. They have strong Islamic fundamentalist influences in their military and intelligence apparatus. Oh, and they have Al-Qaeda operating inside the country, a group that wants to get a nuclear bomb. Plus, they have the ongoing conflict with India. So you have two worries. One is that a terrorist fundamentalist group could get a bomb, and terrorist groups, unlike states, cannot be deterred from using it. If Al-Qaeda got a nuclear weapon, it's pretty clear they would use it or threaten to use it. And the other worry is that some conflict could escalate out of control and there could be a regional nuclear war in South Asia. There's no other country that poses that complex of threats all at once. Pakistan could go from a major non-NATO ally of the United States to our worst nuclear nightmare overnight.
So given all that, are we focusing enough attention on Pakistan?
No, not nearly enough. And in fact, this is one area where I will invoke the International Security Advisory Board. We issued a report last year urging that we take much more steps to resolve the Pakistan situation, both their security situation, their economic situation, and the security of their weapons. They should be getting a lot more of the attention, even if we gave in a fraction of the attention we're devoting to Iran, to Pakistan, we'd all be better off.
I'm going to go to the phones now. We've got a call from Rich in Bloomer. Hi, Rich.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I think he has a good idea of what with Pakistan, of what I've been hearing over the years. But then with the nuclear part, I remember when I was in the military in the 70s, where I was stationed in Europe, we really didn't think anything of it until we would get to another part of the country and hear what they had capabilities of doing. So if everyone went with the eliminate the nuclear weapons, but then all of a sudden the other countries know, okay, that country there, country A, they have the capability of making one, so as long as they don't make one, we really don't need one either. And, well, where I was in the early 70s was in West Berlin.
All right, well, thank you, Rich. Joseph, what do you think?
Sure. So he's talking about the problem of if you try to reduce nuclear weapons and eventually eliminate them, what do you do about the bomb in the basement? What do you do if you wake up one day and after you've gotten rid of your nukes and Canada announces it has a nuclear weapon and wants to renegotiate the border between the two countries? As it turns out, that is really much less of a concern than you might imagine. The United States has formidable conventional military capability, which is enough to deter or respond to any threat, including a nuclear threat. And, of course, if something were to happen, you don't forget how to build nuclear weapons. You choose not to build nuclear weapons. You could always decide that the security situation shifted and you went back up. And that's why many, many people in the American security establishment, including like former Secretary of State George Shultz and former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, have urged us to move steadily towards a world without nuclear weapons, to get rid of these risks and reduce the chance that one of these weapons will be used someday by miscalculation, by accident, or by madness.
Now, Joseph, what do we need to do? What is step one for the United States and for the world at large to live in a world free of nuclear weapons?
Well, the United States and Russia have 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world. So if you're going to start reducing, that's the logical place to start. And President Obama and the President of Russia have recognized this, that these two countries have a special responsibility. So you don't have to decide you're going to get rid of all of them. You can decide you don't need this many of them. Do we really need to have 5,000 nuclear weapons in our active stockpile? It's hard to imagine a military mission that requires one nuclear weapon now, but maybe you need 10 or 50 or 500. If you could say, okay, let's go down to 500 and we'll do it in a verifiable agreement with Russia, you do the same, we do the same, that would be a huge step towards reducing the risks of using these weapons. Step two is then to involve the other countries in this process. So you bring China in and India and Pakistan and the UK, people who already have nuclear arsenals in the low hundreds, and you get them to stop making more and to start reducing them. And step three is then to get down to very low levels, a couple of dozen each, and then you can stop, take a look, and see if you can create the kind of inspection regime that would make each country comfortable getting rid of them altogether. This whole process would probably take something like 20 years.
Is this an all-or-nothing game in that everybody has to be on that page? Everyone has to agree that no one will make nuclear weapons or it doesn't work at all?
In the end, yes, it does. Everyone has to agree. But you know, as it turns out, we're a lot closer than we think. Most of the world has already agreed to this. There are 183 countries in the world that have signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that don't have nuclear weapons and have promised never to get them. And it's not that these countries couldn't. Germany could build a bomb. Japan could build a bomb in, 3 months. They choose not to. So most of the world is already there. And what you're looking at is still the nuclear wave that began with Hiroshima, that is built up during the Cold War, that is now receding. There are fewer and fewer weapons every day. We have to make sure that we get down to low levels quick enough to prevent any of them from being used. Can you get to zero? I think so, but you don't have to agree with that to realize that we'll be much safer just with every step we take towards that goal so nobody ever uses one of these things again.
All right, Joseph, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
We've been talking to Joseph Cerencioni. He's the president of Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, also a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board. And he's the author of Nuclear Nightmares: Securing the World Before It's Too Late.